Miller's Netter, just talking to teachers.
Podcast pedagogy. What is Phil reading this week? Podcast pedagogy. Listening to teachers.
Naylor's Netter, just talking to teachers.
Naylor's Natter the Book. Ideas and advice from the collective wisdom of teachers. Naylor's Natter brings together a wealth of advice from the most influential voices in education today. In this exciting, one-of-a-kind book, Phil Naylor revisits the very best interviews from 3 years of education podcasting, drawing on the advice and opinions from some of the world's most innovative educators. Available now for pre-order from Amazon and out on July 7th, 2022.
Talking to teachers about educational books, why we love them, and how we use them in our classrooms. With guest authors, publishers, podcasters, and of course, teachers.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody. Welcome to another Naylor's Natter. And today we're going to be talking about the unofficial Ofsted Survival Guide. And I'm delighted to be joined by Dominic Sallis. Dominic, welcome to Naylor's Natter.
Thank you ever so much for having me. I listen to you all the time. I'm super excited.
It's a great pleasure. And Dominic's got the added benefit, listener, is he can't see me either because my camera's not working. So it's a real double benefit. Gets me on the podcast and you don't have to look at me. What a treat on a Monday evening. All right. Okay. So we're going to get into this fascinating book, which I know from speaking to people that obviously message me and people that I've met at conferences and people that I chat to on the podcast, a book that people have found extremely useful, helping them with their Ofsted inspection. So Dominic, tell us a little bit before we get into that. Tell us a little bit about you, your career to this point, and kind of your journey in education, if you don't mind.
So I have what's called a portfolio career. So until the age of 28, I was a tax inspector, and my wife was a teacher, and just seeing the difference in her quality of life compared to mine, I thought I'll take the 50% salary cut and become a teacher. And I wanted to be a kind of Mr. Chips, you know, a legend in the community. And I did that for 10 years. And then gradually, changes of leadership and what have you, I just ended up moving schools. And every time you move, you kind of try to get promoted. And I stumbled into the head of English role and then teaching and learning assistant head role in two different schools. Did that for nearly 10 years and then moved to be in charge of curriculum and teaching and learning and stumbled across this very weird idea of just doing it 3 days a week and not teaching to try and turn a school around. So I joined a school in Swindon that was about minus 0.48 for Progress 8. And we managed to turn it around in a year. And the curriculum, teaching, learning side, I couldn't have done full-time in a school, but I could do 3 days a week. And so from that, I've developed a kind of training arm where I help school leaders or heads of department improve teaching and learning in the curriculum. With my wife and a colleague, I train special school heads in how to be school improvement partners. So we're in our third year of that. Each year there's a cohort of 16. And I also have the UK's second largest YouTube channel for teaching GCSE English. And I write education books and loads of revision guides for students and some other stuff. So that's what I mean by portfolio. I do loads of different things. All give me great satisfaction intellectually, and some of them pay.
So. Brilliant. I love that expression, a portfolio career. This is what I'm going to aspire to, Dominic, when I've
finished. You're on your second book now, aren't you? You could be there.
I could be there. Yeah, if someone buys the first one, that might help as well. So please feel free. Still available everywhere. Anyway, let's get into talking about yours. So like I said, lots of people have messaged me to say how they found this really, really useful. And also I might touch on later when people are fascinated by the idea of the kind of 3 day a week person coming in to assist with curriculum and teaching and learning, because it is a job that can be derailed by the day to day, that can be sort of kicked into the long grass when there are either financial issues, behavior issues, HR issues, you name it, any other kind of issues. So that's a fascinating thing, but we'll pick that up later on. Let's get into first that you start the first chapter by talking about the fact that you do agree with the notion of Ofsted, and you've obviously talked about yourself, and you say that you write this as a fan. So tell us a little bit about how you came to write the unofficial Ofsted Survival Guide.
Well, I wrote it immediately after we'd got through our inspection. So after three inspections, I think, over about 10 years of RI, we managed to get a good. And so we prepared for that in the same way that we'd prepare for an exam. And so I thought, well, what if I could write the exam cheat sheet, as it were, for schools? And so I did it originally for the MAT that we're in. And I thought, well, you know, I know my way around self-publishing on Amazon. I'll just publish it as well, and other people can learn from it. I'll sell it at a dirt cheap price, so there's no barrier to people getting hold of it. And the premise was really, Ofsted are human beings. They're actually morally sound. I know quite a few inspectors, morally sound people who want the best for the schools that they inspect. They've got a motto, at least in the Southwest, of do good as you go. And they genuinely see themselves that way. And so I thought, well, could we use that to kind of guide the team during the inspection as friends of the Ofsted team? And so the book was trying to get schools on a footing where they would be a friend to the team who would anticipate their needs before they arose and therefore just make the inspection so much smoother. And from that, a fair judgment much more likely.
Great stuff. Okay, so obviously everybody at some point will be involved in an inspection at whatever level that may be, whether you're a classroom teacher, a teaching assistant, senior leaders, governors, you know, MATs, whatever it might be. So you start off, and again, this is almost like that exam cheat sheet that you're talking about. You almost start off with a revision plan, don't you? Kind of talking about what sort of things you should put in place before the inspection. You start it off, and I love this, don't you? You start it off by saying, you know they're coming. You know? And we all do. But again, as I said to you before, it kind of, you know, goes down and down the priorities list. It's always on there somewhere, but it goes further and further down. So tell us how we can move that up to the sort of, not the top of the list, but certainly on the list, and tell us a little bit about what you'd advise people to do before an inspection.
So in terms of within the school, the focus on the curriculum, I think, is a brilliant, brilliant thing. So this is a slight digression, but what I discovered in my role is that if I wanted to improve teaching and learning across the school, it was so much easier to do it through concentrating on the curriculum rather than traditional CPD. So we were ahead of the Ofsted curve, the new framework, by about 18 months. We introduced a curriculum review where we went back to first principles, and we talked about how are we going to get the kids to remember what we teach them. So we did all the long-term memory stuff, Ebbinghaus forgetting curve, space learning, interleaving, retrieval practice. All that stuff was done way before the framework was written. We also thought, well, what's the valuable stuff to teach? And so we blitzed knowledge organizers and we stripped out of the curriculum stuff we didn't value. And that was, I found, liberating as a way to get teams to focus on what really mattered to them rather than just whole school CPD imposed by the SLT. And so part of the Ofsted preparation is making sure that your teams have really thought through the curriculum in those terms. You know, are you teaching the right stuff? Are you teaching it in a way that's going to make it stick? And have you fully considered long-term memory? Added to that, your assessments build long-term memory and your homework builds long-term memory. And so actually map that across the year so that you know as a head of department, the kids are going to learn as much as they possibly can of what you teach them. And that then makes the curriculum discussion for Ofsted an absolute breeze because they're not used to that. In fact, we were inspected in, I think it was January 2020, so it was early on in the new framework. And the lead inspector didn't have a clue what she was looking at in the sense that she hadn't come across such a well-integrated curriculum before. And we almost fell foul of the fact that she didn't understand it. But they're much more experienced now, so hopefully you won't have that same problem we did. And then this leads me to the second thing. You want to get a folder on your website, which is for the inspector. And you're going to put into that everything that you think will be useful to help them understand your context and what you do. because when you get the 90-minute phone call with the lead, it probably won't be 90 minutes. It'll probably end up being 60 minutes. The poor lead inspector is under time pressure. They are taking notes as you speak, so they've got split attention. So they're not going to remember fully what you've explained. And so if you've got that kind of cheat sheet for the inspector, they're going to understand your school context when they sort of trawl through your school website much, much more deeply than when they get the conversation. And the two together should mean that they've got a real understanding of your context and what you're doing as a leadership team to improve. So that's a great way to control the communication and the inspector's understanding. And the other thing that's super important is it's only the lead inspector who reads that, and the rest of the team don't have a Scooby-Doo what's on your website, and they don't care. They haven't got time to look. So, you know, you at least need to make sure the lead knows that, because the team are going to hear it secondhand. So the next bit of advice is day one, can you get a meeting with your teaching and learning lead, your curriculum lead and the head, and the inspector team, just so that you can go over the key things that you want them to know? Again, don't rely on your expert knowledge to tell them. Give yourself your own cheat sheet. These are the six things we want them to know, little bullet points for yourself. Right, this is what we're going to explain. And so you're really focused. You're really respectful of the inspector's time. They don't want to be derailed. And they're going to find that time with you useful, rather than a way of you trying to control the agenda in their eyes.
It's absolutely brilliant, Dominic. Absolutely brilliant. And I mean, as I said to you before, I've spoken to people who found it hugely useful. And one person I spoke to is leading on teaching and learning. Now, I won't name them mostly on a podcast because that would be appropriate. But the natural tendency when you're leading on teaching and learning is to look at the pedagogical principles in the classroom and lots of techniques that teachers can deploy from their toolbox in the classroom to improve learning. So, you know, you might be able to spend a lot of time working out your do now or your scaffolding your modeling or all these kind of things. But something when I was reading your book that really struck with me, and hopefully I'm going to quote this correctly, you talked about doing learning walks with curriculum leads but ignoring teaching and learning, which I just thought just caused me huge cognitive dissonance. That I was thinking, you're doing a learning walk with heads of department or subject leads, whatever it might be, and ignoring what you see in the classroom. So just tell us a little bit more about what you mean by that and how you use book looks, in a hugely positive way working with those subject leads.
Oh, well, Phil, first, congratulations on being my first customer who's really zoned in on that. I think it's absolutely fundamental. But because it does cause such cognitive dissonance, most people just ignore it. And I'm just so thrilled that that struck a chord with you, because it seems so odd. So I'm a massive fan of the 10,000 hour rule. You know, you have deliberate practice for 10,000 hours, and then you finally master what you're doing. And so I had 10,000 hours of being a teaching and learning lead and focusing on all these fantastic teaching and learning techniques before I had this amazing insight that it doesn't matter how good your teachers are, it's what the kids are learning and how well they're learning that makes the difference to their progress. And actually, if I go into a lesson and ignore what the teacher's doing, but look at how the students are learning and what they're learning, and then if I look at the books and see what does the journey in the book suggest that the kids are learning, I'll suddenly have a profound understanding of what the curriculum is making the students do. So I have a phrase that I use, that the curriculum isn't what you teach, it's what the students do. And once you appreciate that, everything kind of slots into place. So, for example, if I'm going into a lesson and I can see that the teacher isn't delivering a do now properly, which is going to be a retrieval practice, that would be a useful bit of feedback. But if I can see that during the do nows, the teacher is only setting five questions and the kids are only answering three of them, I now have a department-wide inquiry. Why are we only setting five questions to do in 8 minutes? Might we set 20 or 30? And, you know, if they shift the curriculum to 20 or 30 questions, well, that's going to have an exponential effect on what students know and remember, compared to if I improve that teacher's delivery of the DNA so they do all five. So that's just an example, but everything that you spot in a lesson, you're asking yourself, what are the implications for the curriculum? Will this be relevant across the team? And if so, oh my God, what a golden nugget that is, because my 5 minutes in this lesson is suddenly going to transform the curriculum we deliver after next week, because we'll make a quick change that will benefit so many people. And it's the same with books. You know, you'll find teachers have different ways of taking notes, and then you'll see, oh, hang on, this led to a really great piece of work, but it didn't in the other classroom. Okay, teacher X, you're going to train us the next department meeting because you've found this way of taking notes that we're not using. Teach us, we're going to use it from now on. And suddenly the curriculum becomes a self-improving system through your learning walks, precisely because you're looking at learning and not at teaching. It's also hugely more supportive for the teacher because no one wags a finger at them and says, well, you're not doing that right. So that also is a massive benefit in terms of staff morale and building teamwork.
Brilliant. Thank you, Dominic. And obviously people will be rushing out to go and buy the book anyway. But if there's one reason to buy it, I think it's that shift. If you are somebody, and like I said, the person I've spoken to is, if you're a lead on teaching and learning, this is just a totally different way of looking at it. But when you think about it, it really does make sense. It really does make sense, because doing it the other way around is just, you know, it's techniques without any substance. Whereas, you know, you can still build in, presumably later on, you can still say, right, based on the curriculum, there are some of these pedagogical techniques that will suit the cognitive science of retrieval practice, for example, and here's what it looks like. But you should do it that way around and not do lots of fancy techniques with no substance and no curriculum basis behind them in the first instance.
Yeah, I mean, on the we haven't just abandoned teaching, but we got a group together with Teach Like a Champion 2.0, I think it was then. And we said, right, what are the key techniques that are going to make the most progress for students? So again, not looking at it from the teacher perspective, but what's going to lead to most progress? And we agreed on 8. And so they became our essential 8. And that's what all our teaching training is loaded into, just 8 techniques. So everyone can master them. And, you know, you don't know if they're going to be right, but it automatically gives buy-in because it's been chosen by the team. It also gives great clarity because you've named every technique and there's only 8 to choose from. And we divided those into doing the basics brilliantly, a kind of standard model. And then if you wanted to do the same techniques to an expert model, we provided that as well. And I road tested this with my daughter. So she was never going to teach. She tried real life for a bit. And has a psychology degree and retrained as an English teacher. And I said to her, look, the quality of your training, in my experience trying to hire teachers, is going to be poor. No matter how reputable the institution you go to, it's really not going to prepare you with the practicalities of how kids learn. But don't worry, I'll train you. And so that her PGCE was... it was actually lots worse than I expected. She was distraught with a lot of the training she had. But anyway, she persevered. And she wanted to work in Wales. So she was confined to where she could get a job. And she taught health and social care for the first 2 years and got higher results than the head of department. Then for 2 years, she went to teach A-level psychology and got the record results the school had ever had. And I trained her as a teacher in these 8 techniques remotely. I've never seen her teach. All we did is chat on the phone once a week, and we just talked about those 8. We also obviously talked about curriculum design, but it's a very small sample set. But I was absolutely thrilled that doing that actually made teaching for her super simple. And she's also very, very jealous of her time. And so she did that in... you know, less than 9 to 5 hours. She surfs. So, you know, once the school bell went, that's it. She was out down the beach. But she was able to combine the two just by having that narrow focus.
Sounds idyllic there. A little bit of teaching and a little bit of surfing. Fantastic. Fantastic. The work-life balance. Right, Dominic. I mean, obviously, everybody's fascinated what we've talked about so far, but this particular bit is something that most of the listeners won't have experience of and maybe will never get experience of, but it's something that we've all wondered what actually happens. So, you know, when people talk on Twitter or social media and say, you know, we've had the call, nobody apart from head teachers who are listening, and thank you if you are, have actually had the experience of the call, the 90-minute phone call, which you said sometimes can be maybe a little bit shorter, and perhaps in some circumstances it could be a little bit longer. So tell us a little bit about how that goes, what kind of things are discussed on there, and then what kind of impact that might have on the inspection and how we prepare for it as a wider team in the school.
Okay, so this is the opportunity for the lead inspector to find out the context of the school. And so what you need to be aware of is they've been into lots of schools and they've got a kind of average vision of what a school with your progress results and profile will look like. And so they won't ever say this, they want to be open-minded, but we're all human. So if you've read your Daniel Kahneman, you'll know about type one and type two thinking is what we all do. They will have a mental picture of your school based on their experience, which of course will be wrong. They won't know that they're hanging on to that picture. So, you know, if you've got minus progress eight, they're simply going to assume there's probably key things wrong with leadership. And they've probably got a very strong preconception about what those things will be. Lack of consistency, subject variation, all those things are predictable. So your job in the 90-minute phone call and their job is to unpick their preconceptions. So they're going to ask you really about those three things, your intent, implementation, and impact of the curriculum. They're going to want to know how you build long-term memory, how you stop within-school variation. They're going to probably start really gently before any of that and try and understand the school context. You know, what's the journey been like? What are your kids like? What are the challenges? What are the barriers? Part of me thinks that's just a kind of psychological ploy to get you to open up. And part of me thinks, well, maybe they actually care. So I'm undecided on that one. I guess it depends on the inspector. Again, I would have your journey and your context in the lead inspector's folder on the computer already. No more than a side of A4. You know, this is why we are like we are. This is what our journey's been like over the last 3, 4, 5 years, whatever's relevant to, I guess, the head's tenure. So then they are going to ask about which subjects to go into. And again, you can plan that in advance. So if you go to the IDSR, you know they're going to focus probably 4 out of 5 subjects on the EBAC. Now, they might not, but they probably will. They'll definitely pick at least 3. And you know that in advance. So you know from your progress results which ones you want them to go into. And then you also know the subjects that are problematic and they're going to go into something that's not doing well. So they'll pick your worst subjects. And you can be quite tactical in steering them towards, you know, a subject that you want. So typically, for example, MFL nearly always has low value added or minus value added, but they're often run pretty well. And of course, the curriculum is always sequenced because they're always learning new stuff. That's just how a language works. So it's really easy to blag a good kind of report on languages because it's impossible to design a bad sequence. And as long as you've got, you know, some good teaching, which you probably will do, that's what languages teachers try and do, you're probably going to end up with a good picture. Or you might be thinking, right, well, we've got a subject that just teaches Key Stage 4, maybe it's business studies, but those results are fantastic. Let's see if we can find a way to get the team into that. Can we build some links with wider school issues like reading or SEND or PSHE? Is there some kind of connection we can get with business studies there to suggest that they ought to go and see that? So reading is an obvious link. You know, you've got all this business jargon. How does the team make that accessible if they're getting great results? And then you can use that as part of your evidence of what you're doing for reading. So be tactical about which teams they're going to go into. And then, of course, the other ones are, you know, if you've got some departments that aren't really doing well, then you know there's a high, especially if they're in the EBAC, there's a high chance the team are going to go in. So prep them beforehand. And I don't mean kind of do a top-down Ofsted deep dive, we're doing this to you. It's right, let's work out what the rules of the exam are. Let's rehearse the exam. So when the team come here, we're presenting a really coherent picture, which they'll understand. Because ultimately, and this is a personal view, the Ofsted team want to have faith in the leadership. And if you can persuade them that you understand the situation in your department or your school or your team, and that you are therefore taking steps to change the bits that aren't working, then they're going to give you the benefit of the doubt. In other words, if you're measuring the impact and responding, that's a big tick in their mind, even if your impact is low at this stage. So rehearsing that, planning which departments to get them into first, is utterly crucial.
Again, great advice, Dominic. Thank you. So the next bit is, and we're going to leave the listener wanting more. We're not going to go through the whole book because, you know, otherwise people won't be rushing out to pick it up. And again, exactly. for the 166th time, listener, I am not getting paid to endorse these books. These are the books that I and other people will hopefully find useful. So we always want to leave people wanting more. So one of the things, Dominic, and I've obviously experienced this many times as a teacher, in school, is the staff meeting. So you know you've received an email that says your whole staff to the sports hall or the theatre or the hall, wherever it is, at the end of the day, and you think, right, we know what this is going to be. So you might think, well, that's not really an important meeting in a sense that you just get a bit of information and obviously then people can go and get on with what they're doing. But what I like is what you've put in here again, where you said, communicate confidence, purpose, anticipation, and a lack of stress. And our head told everyone that she'll be leaving at 5:30 and told everyone to get off my land, and we did. Whereas you could think of many sort of anecdotal experiences where, right, Ofsted are coming in, right, we better order in the pizzas, we better make sure that we've got the takeaways coming in, tell the caretaker we're opening till 10 o'clock at night and make sure your display boards are sorted. But actually that, you know, it might be counterproductive in a lot of ways because it communicates the idea that we're not quite ready and we're rushing around last minute to try and get a few things done, and that can have a knock-on effect. So tell us the importance of the tone of that staff meeting.
Yeah, I can't overemphasize the importance of that. So, you know, as a head, many heads, they don't sleep until Wednesday's gone and they know they're not going to get the phone call. And if you pass that on to your team, the level of stress will mount up around you, and actually then the head will be even more stressed. And so a fantastic insight that I got from our head was, let's prepare in the background, and then the SLT, through the things that I've been talking about, already know they're super prepared. The heads of department already know they're super prepared because they've spent this time thinking about the sequencing of the curriculum and how kids are going to remember it. So there's nothing really else to worry about other than safeguarding. So we'll leave that out of it, because most teachers aren't worried that there's going to be a safeguarding incident while the inspectors are in the room. So all they have to worry about is, do I understand the curriculum I'm delivering? Do I understand why it goes in that sequence? Yes, I do. The Ofsted team therefore can't ask me anything I'm not prepared for. Now, I didn't put in the book, I don't think. What we also did is we got the teams together once we knew which subjects were going to be done. And we said, right, okay, let's just sit down. We'd already prepared an overview of what the curriculum was going to look like. Very, very broad strokes, side of A4. So they knew what to talk about. We then just said, okay, right, let's just plan which lessons they're likely to go into. Probably going to be lessons 1 to 4, if you're a 5-lesson day, maybe 1 to 5. And we're just going to spend half an hour thinking, okay, which teachers do we want them to go into? We'll give them a spread of Key Stage 3 and Key Stage 4. And what will we say about the curriculum? And so that would just be, the students are studying this today. That leads to what they did over the last month and what's coming in the next month. And that's literally 3 bullet points for each teacher about each class. So that takes about half an hour to do. Everyone's on the same page. They know that those are the key things they're going to have to tell the inspection team about sequencing. they can tell them anything else, but we're not going to bother prepping them for that. So the deep dive subjects are under a bit more pressure, but they too, you know, they can have all that done and dusted by 4 o'clock. So staff meeting, 4 o'clock, and the head says and conveys, we've got this. We're totally prepared. The school will not let us down. We're going to show ourselves in the best light. And that's all we can do. You know, we're not worried about what the judgment's going to be because that's out of our hands. But we're going to show the inspectors exactly what we do and they're going to understand it properly. You guys are ready. Do not be stressed. Get off my land. And that's, I find that inspirational because, I don't know, maybe one in 50 heads will do that. You know, it's definitely not what your staff are expecting. And it just feels like a kind of Agincourt moment, you know, where you're going into battle and you simply can't lose.
Yeah, and it keeps your exam preparation analysis going as well, doesn't it? In the sense that we can all remember doing exams and then thinking, right, well, if I've really got to cram that much the night before, then perhaps I've let myself down in the preparation and my revision program for the weeks, months, years previous to that. You know, I know there's a natural tendency to want to go over your notes one more time the night before, and that's natural. But having to stay up until whatever time with, and I'm showing my age, Dominic, you know, with Pro Plus or whatever it is to try and get you through the night. You know, I mean, it's all Red Bull now, isn't it? Or something else, I don't know. But, you know, that shouldn't be necessary if you're prepared. And this kind of plays into that. But like you said, for the school leaders that are listening, it's really powerful to see that the person who's ultimately in charge and ultimately will have their name on this report is saying to you, we're ready.
Yeah.
Go home at 5:30. We've got this. And that really does give you confidence as the person that's obviously either being observed or facing meetings for the next 2 days.
Exactly. I love that analogy as well.
Good stuff. Right, now, this is something interesting, Dominic, because obviously we've conversed over the popular social media, which is LinkedIn, and amongst other places as well. Now, you've put later on in the book about researching your team, and I suspect that this is something that perhaps has come up quite recently because I hadn't necessarily thought of this or heard of this before. This idea, I'm not saying you have to use LinkedIn for it, listener, by the way, there's other ways to do it, but looking into the backgrounds and, you know, the kind of human aspect of the team that's coming in, and not as a way of trying to catch people out, but just to get a bit of context. So as you've rightly put here, the people who are Ofsted inspectors, and, you know, I've worked with people who've been Ofsted inspectors, they've been school leaders, or they may still be school leaders. They may work in a particular environment, which may be very similar to yours. So you'll be able to, you know, look into what kind of things they've done and whether that marries with yours. And it strikes a little bit of rapport as well, doesn't it? And that little bit of understanding. So tell us what you mean by researching your team and how that can be useful as part of the process.
Yeah. So from an inspector's point of view, the very worst thing is a senior leader following them around, kind of trying to second guess everything, you know, questioning the kid just after the inspector's been there or trying to show the inspector stuff. What they don't want is anyone managing their time and managing their experience. It'll just feel as though you have something to hide. So the way to kind of build rapport with the inspector, or one of them, is to think, well, what's their experience? So for example, our lead inspector had been a head teacher of a school that had never got above average progress 8. In fact, she was, I think it had been negative. I can't be sure of that. And so we knew that the stuff that we were telling her about how we designed our curriculum would not make sense to her. She would never have seen it before. We also knew she was recently appointed as an HMI, so she wouldn't have had the background experience within Ofsted to have seen it before. And so we knew, therefore, that that was a potential pinch point. And it turned out to be so. And, you know, we were alert to it. Then if you know the subject specialism of your HMI, you can see that, or your ordinary inspector, it's very likely that they're not inspecting their subject specialism. And therefore, you will probably have a better understanding of the curriculum than they are. So when you're, let's say, in the deep dive conversation, I said you put a senior leader in with the head of department, The head of department is going to answer every single question and you're not going to interfere. But you will know aspects of the curriculum that the head of department might not have asked, and the lead inspector hasn't thought to ask because they're not experienced in your subject. And so you can just say to the head of department, oh, that links to what you do in your assessments in year nine, doesn't it? Would you mind explaining that to the lead or to the inspector? And then the head of department will just go on and do that explanation for you. Similarly, when you're walking around the lessons, you will know the significance of how the books are organised and how they link to homework and how they link to an assessment. And the inspector won't be able to see that, and they won't know which questions to ask the kids to find out. And so it's very easy for you to just point them towards that, you know, just say, oh, right, this is supposed to link to the homework. You might want to ask the student how successful that is. And therefore, the student can still say, no, this is absolute rubbish, sir. We don't learn anything. You're not controlling it that way. But you are controlling the game in the sense that the inspector knows that, in theory, the curriculum design means that what the kids do in the books does link to the homework. There is a progression intent there. Let's explore it. And that gives you a much better control of what the inspector's seeing. I hope that's clear. Because I'm very wary that I'm describing it in a way that sounds like you're interfering with the inspector's job. And that's 100% what you shouldn't do, because they'll hate you for it.
No, not at all. It sounds as if you're helping people. And that's what this book is all about. You're helping people to get inside of the whole situation and, you know, to prepare yourself. But bigger than that, Dominic, you're talking about things that are potentially good practice anyway. That's really useful. So a senior leader sitting in with their head of department, looking through books, and then perhaps involving some kind of student voice around that and seeing how these things join up is actually going to help develop your curriculum further, look into staff development. It's actually a beneficial thing to do if you weren't subject to an inspection. So actually,
yes,
describing things that are useful parts of, you know, arguably professional development, you know, but certainly curriculum development and teaching and learning development, these are good things to kind of practice and get involved with. And those close relationships between, you know, senior leaders and heads of departments are crucial, because a senior leader can be, you know, across many different subjects in a secondary school and potentially can be across, you know, many lots of different subjects in primary school across different phases as well.
Brilliant. I totally agree. And I'm really glad you took that out of the book as well. You're making me very happy, Phil.
Well, this is why we got you on. I mean, you know, these, like I said, the listener won't believe me, but these are the things that people ask for and these things that people want to do. And I just found myself thinking, right, these are really useful. And hence the reason this is all the podcast about, sharing this good practice with lots of other people. Right. Speaking of which, then, I know that things have moved on slightly a little bit in the last year or so since this book has been written about two particular topics. Okay. So we're going to look at the looking Ofsted's focus on absence.
Yes.
And then also Ofsted focus on send. So obviously absence is quite a challenging one at the moment. It does plug for own talk, but I'm going out and speaking at Research Ed Cheshire this weekend about book number two. Listeners are sick of hearing about it. Some schools are harder than others. And one of the challenges there is that schools that could be described loosely, and it's not a scientific definition, as harder, although yes, I have done a lot of research around the data for that, will suffer more from higher figures of absence. So what would be your suggestion for perhaps, you know, teachers, senior leaders, attendance leads, whatever it might be, about the kind of conversations they can have about absence and what kind of impact those could have on the overall grading and rating of a school?
This is really tricky. So I'll tell you a range of things and then you can tell me some better ones that you might have come across. So absence is a really, really tough nut to crack. So if we go back to the intent, implementation and impact model, you need a plan for absence. So how do you respond to it? And you need a team that has a particular plan. So, you know, what letters do they send out to parents? How have they tested the wording of those letters? So, you know, go to research on, the nudge unit, something like that. See what will try and persuade the parents to send their kids to school. How can you frame it as a social norm? How do you link that to assemblies and tutor time? How do you show the results of attendance with progress? because your school results are bound to show a huge correlation between kids turn up, they get better grades. How do you make the kids and the parents aware of that? And then so on, all the way down the line. You know, who do you send out to the students' houses to try and get them in? What do you do when that doesn't work? So when Ofsted can see that you've got a totally coherent plan that way, the fact that you're unsuccessful because you've got really hard to reach kids is not necessarily going to count against you as much, because you're doing everything. And, you know, if the Ofsted inspector's not convinced, you can say, well, what else would you like me to show you, you know, to try and persuade you? And usually they won't be able to think of something. If you've thought through how to deal with absence properly, they're not going to come up with something that you haven't thought of. And if they do, that's great. They're going to do good as they go, and you're going to find a way to improve your absence situation. The other thing that you should do is look at your Progress 8 results by attendance. I can't overemphasize this enough. So if I go back to 2022, the school I was in, the school that I was in originally when we got inspected, I then became a consultant for, and I was in, you know, 1 or 2 days a week, not on a contract, but on an ad hoc basis. They ended up with, I think it was minus 0.07 Progress 8. So they'd gone down about 0.1, having had this massive increase of plus 0.5. And, you know, the head was distraught. The leadership team was sort of downbeat about it. And I said, well, you know, before you start rushing into changing stuff, let's just look at how the kids did who had 95% attendance or more. And they had a Progress 8 of nearly 0.9. So when I did that analysis, I said, look, this is proof of concept that your curriculum is absolutely smashing it. The teaching and learning must be smashing it. You're doing a fantastic job. And then you could say, well, you know, let's look at kids who had like 88% percent attendance to 95. Oh, they're smashing it as well. And so then you've got the hard to reach kids who are bringing the overall Progress 8 down. And you can come up with a story of, well, not I don't mean a fiction, I mean a narrative. This is what we are doing to try and address that. And this is how we're measuring the impact. So we've got a war wall in the head's office, the attendance at every year group, and it gets updated every day. And she knows who the key kids are and who's going out to see them and what's being done. She gets an update every day. Now, those updates every day could, in theory, lead to no improvement in attendance. But an inspectorate couldn't come in and say, you're ignoring your attendance problem. They'll say, Christ, they're doing everything humanly possible to try and improve it. And therefore, we can't suggest that there requires improvement or inadequate on the basis of that, because they've got a totally coherent plan.
Well, just to start with, I certainly don't have any better suggestions than that. So that is, you know, in a nutshell, I can't have anything necessarily to add to that. What I do like, though, is this idea that your attendance figures, which may be influenced by external factors, so, you know, the number of, I'm not saying it's directly linked to disadvantage, but that's a factor in it.
Sure,
you know,
is.
And then obviously post-pandemic, but different communities have been, you know, disproportionately affected compared to others. But what I like that what you've talked about there is you're talking about, as you say in the book, persistence absence needs a plan, rather than throwing resources at the problem without a strategic plan and without a clear measure of impact. It's, again, a regular, revisited, planned activity that doesn't fall off when the latest crisis pops up or something else happens. So you're talking there about, you know, the harder to reach students going out and being picked up or visited. Well, that doesn't stop because there's another priority this week, and then forget about it for 3 months and revisit it. It's that kind of, right, well, I've done everything we could possibly do, and attendance still stands at 91.4, whatever it is. But, you know,
we'd kill for that attendance.
Well, I think nationally everybody would, wouldn't they? Currently, I think that's I was trying to be aspirational there, but well, I think that's absolutely right. And there's nothing more then that you could possibly do. It's of the same things with this exam analogy that we keep talking about. Even if I'm not going to get a grade 9 in my biology exam, I'm going to give everything I can possibly do. I've got a revision plan. I've got the textbooks. I've done the exam practice. I've had a parent test me on it. I've done everything I could possibly do. So I go into the exam and I still only get a 6, but I've given it everything I can possibly do. And that's what you're talking about in terms of this one. Right. Now, this little bit now, Dominic, I don't normally get to listener questions, but I have got a question about this one because, you know, I have been on this theme previously. So behavior.
Yes.
If you're trying really hard to make sure that behavior is good, then suspensions are one tool to be able to make behavior. Now, I know I can hear people shouting at the podcast, but do you know what? Nothing wrong with a bit of controversy now and again, is there? Yeah. It gets a bit of interaction. And it's not just it's the only way, but that may, in the short term, make the behavior seem much calmer, quieter, better in the classroom. But a line of inquiry surely will be set off if suspension figures are too high. So how does somebody who's in charge of behavior go about balancing or squaring that circle of, right, to have better behavior in school and particularly on those days, suspensions may have to be a tool to be used, but then having too many suspensions can cause you the issue where behavior is arguably, you know, inadequate or, you know, really quite problematic. How do you go about making those decisions? And again, I get the feeling where you're going to go with this about having a plan, but go on, tell us what that is for behavior.
Well, I'm sort of the worst person to ask about this because I don't have to carry the can. You know, in terms of my role in schools, I've never had to carry the can for suspensions and exclusions. But I'll tell you why I think what I think with the proviso that I may be utterly wrong. So everything is led by the data. So a reasonable question to ask is, what will the progress rate of this kid be if we do not suspend them? And it wouldn't be hard for you as a team to think, well, you know, let's say they're in year 11, just for example. They're on an average of a grade 2 at the minute. If we don't suspend them, they're probably not going to go up to a grade 3. Okay, well, what's the likely impact on the other 5 kids in every class that they're in, or 10 kids in every class that they're in? Is it likely to affect their progress rate? Yeah, it probably will. And it's really easy to do a back of the envelope calculation to say, oh, overall, you know, they're all going to go down a third of a grade if this kid isn't suspended. And that's a lot of grades overall. Whereas by suspending the kid, in theory, we have a chance of turning them around. Their progress isn't going to go down because not doing any work when they come to the class anyway. In fact, they're disrupting other people. So now I have a really clear rationale for my moral purpose of suspending that kid. Well, then I have to have a plan. So if you've got kids who are regularly being suspended, and you know, you might say regular is twice, what's the next stage intervention? So I've got a friend who's leading on this in his school. He used to have my role. And there was a very serious incident in the school. Behaviour got worse, and a kid threw a chair off a balcony to hit a teacher on the head, and it did hit the teacher on the head. Lots of repercussions. And my friend said, "Look, I'll give up teaching, learning, and curriculum because that's not the main problem in our school. Behaviour is. Put me in charge." And he went to a meeting with the LA. And they said, right, you've just got to keep intervening until the very end, until you've exhausted everything. And he said, well, that's not realistic in a school. You know, am I going to do 100 interventions? No. That wouldn't be realistic. Okay, 50. Well, we couldn't put a number on it. Well, why couldn't you put a number on it? You know, we only get so much money and we only have so much resources in terms of time and expertise. How many interventions should we do? And so he came away enraged about this and said, right, we're just going to do 15. And negotiated with all the other leaders in the school, and they've ended up with a suite of 22. But what that gives him is a plan. He says, right, for every kid who's in need of support, we've got a suite of 22 interventions. They're all going to be time-bound, let's say 6 weeks. We're going to measure the impact of each one, and we're going to know the sequence for each kid of what to go to next. But once they've got to the end of those 22, they are gone. We cannot do any more. And no one can turn around and say we haven't done enough. No one can turn around and say we haven't planned. And no one can turn around and say the kid hasn't had as many chances to meet their needs as possible unless they think our interventions are rubbish. Well, they can't think our interventions are rubbish because we've planned them, and also we measure the impact of every one. And if the impact's rubbish, then we change the intervention. So that's never going to happen. Therefore, suspending a kid is absolutely ideal for the rest of the class, but it's also absolutely ideal for that kid because it's going to identify the right interventions on that 22 intervention journey. Now, obviously, the 22 aren't going to be appropriate for every kid, so I don't know what the actual sequence would be, but you then time bound and you can also cost the interventions. So you can sit down with a parent and say, right, you know, we're giving your child anger management. That's going to cost £500 per hour or whatever it is. This is how we've costed it. We're investing that in your child because you have not done this as a parent, but we will do it for you because we care about your kid. The next intervention comes along. Right, we're going to give 6 hours of training or 20 hours, whatever it is. It costs this for us to deliver it. We're doing this for your child because we care. Well, you know, either the parent gets the message that you're doing these interventions because you care about the kid, or they don't. And I'm really brutal about it. You know, we put in everything we can. We have a kind of maximum budget. You know, if we're getting, I don't know, 6,000 quid for the kid and our interventions take us to 15,000, then what are we going to do? Take all that money away from the other kids? No, we're not. We've spent the 15,000. We've given all the interventions we can. Goodbye. So I know that's very controversial, but that's how I do it.
So what we're going to do is we're going to finish and say to listeners to leave them wanting more. But before we do, Dominic, are you okay to tell us a little bit more about where people can get in touch with you? Because, you know, not trying to big you up too much, you sound like the kind of person that everybody needs in their school, aren't they? I mean, I think I can imagine listeners will be queuing up here for this kind of advice. So tell us a little bit about where listeners can, one, get the book, two, get in touch with you, and three, yes, about what kind of services and things that you're doing in your portfolio of work that you've got going on at the moment.
Well, I mean, the easiest place to get hold of me is LinkedIn. I came off Twitter for my mental health in, I think it was 2017. So you can't find me there. You can contact me through my YouTube channel if you're curious. In terms of what I can do for schools, I'm really open to anything that involves improving teaching, learning and the curriculum, whole school or department-wise. And, get in touch. I don't ever pursue work. It's all word of mouth. I don't advertise. My YouTube and publishing empire, as I call it, to big myself up in my own house, has finally turned into a sustainable business. And so the school stuff I do is a passion project, and it's kind of a way of passing on my expertise. And if I don't get work, it absolutely doesn't matter because I've got loads of other things to get on with. And equally, if I do get work, I'm very happy to build relationships and just try and make the world a better place, as it were. So do get in touch if you want. And if you don't, go and buy a book. And if you don't want a book, then listen to the podcast because it's brilliant. I would actually say, as a fan, I like podcasts that go on longer than expected because I listen to them on 1.5 speed. So I listen to them in under the hour, but I get fantastic value if you ever fancy changing that.
Yes, well, I mean, I can only imagine what my voice sounds like. It's bad enough at the best of times without one being 1.5 speed. Goodness knows what that must sound like. But yes, you said, Dominic, you said that you're going to make the world a better place. And you've certainly done that this evening for all the listeners who will benefit hugely, as I know lots of people have already, from the unofficial Ofsted Survival Guide. Thank you so much, Dominic, for your time tonight. Really, really appreciate it.
Thank you. See you soon, I hope.
Nimmer's Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA 1977 on Twitter.
Nimmer's Netter, just talking to teachers.